This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Finance Advisory are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Unfortunately, things are going from bad to worse. What I talked to you about last week in terms of the states and their problems with their financing is clearly taking a remarkable turn for the worse. The Pew Center, which is an organization that involves itself with surveys and government bodies of one sort or another, have recently been looking at how the rest of the states are doing, other than California, which we all know is a complete basket case in its own right. It has focused on 10 states that also have very severe problems. Sales tax receipts are down 14% in Arizona. State income taxes are down 32%. On average, revenues are down almost 12%. Oregon has seen their revenues collapse a stunning 19%. New York is down 17% with a deficit of 32%. Illinois has a projected deficit of 47% of its budget, second only to California with 49%. The Licio report notes that all states had negative year-over-year sales tax collections in October, and the weighted average decrease was 10.2%, which is down from a negative 7.2% in September. Sales at Walmart stores slipped by 0.4% in the third quarter. Actual government figures show that the retail sales were down 1.5% in September from the previous month and 5.8% year over year. So how do we keep seeing headlines about retail sales being up as unemployment keeps rising? Remember that such reports are usually based on surveys and generally cover mid-sized and up retailers, leaving out smaller businesses. And then in addition, if you are a retail chain that has closed 10% of its stores, the remaining stores should in theory benefit from getting your loyal customers into them. So if things are so bad, how did we have a 3% growth in the third quarter? Well, that 3 or 3.5% number is a preliminary estimate. A study by Goldman Sachs suggests that the number will be revised down by at least 0.5% and maybe as much as 1%. Well, why? The estimate doesn't really take into account how poorly small businesses are performing. If you look at small business indexes and compare them to historical GDP numbers, you get the smaller number that I just mentioned. And since at least 2% of the GDP was from the stimulus package, you know, the cash for clunkers, the houses, the tax cuts, the economy on its own was flat. And that begs the question, what happens when the stimulus runs out? Well, we're not going to know for some time, since the stimulus was just getting ramped up. According to the CBO estimates, only 21% of the stimulus spending will occur in 2009, another 38% will come in 2010, and even more in 2011. And after that, of course, its effect will dissipate quickly. And it's been shown time after time that this concept of a stimulus package simply has the effect of transferring money from one group to another group, but it doesn't actually achieve any lasting wealth effect. David Rosenberg, that I read very frequently, recently noted that what the federal government is giving, the states are taking away. The Pew study shows that at least 9 other states are in appalling shape. 9 states are in fiscal distress and only 2 have balanced budgets. States like Michigan are planning 20% budget cuts for the coming year. Indiana is planning a 10% spending cut in light of a 7.4% year-on-year revenue decline. How can the economy really be out of recession if government revenues are still deflating? The states are filling around 40% of their fiscal gaps with federal stimulus. Even after the fiscal help from Washington, the state governments will still face a projected deficit of $142 billion for 2011 versus $113 billion in 2010. All in all, the restraint in the state and local government sector is estimated to drain a full percentage point from U.S. GDP growth in 2010 and more than fully offset the stimulative effects from Washington. The U.S. economy is more likely to post growth of little more than 2% next year, rather than the 5% currently being discounted by the equity market. Well, I mean, all this is going to put enormous continued pressure on employment. The number of unemployed actually soared by 558,000 to 15.7 million, as measured by the household survey, not the 190,000 you read about in the mainstream media. Unemployment is continuing to rise by significant amounts. About 15 million new jobs over the next 5 years are needed just to get back to when the recession started. It amounts to 250,000 jobs, new jobs every month, for about 5 years. And the country is still losing more than that number a month, let alone adding the needed 250,000. So, you know, I have to wonder if I'm able to come with all this information, and this information is, in every case, information that's culled from very credible sources, even if they're not all government sources. How is it that the government themselves don't seem to understand the implications of this? And I mean, you know, we're talking about whether government is being dishonest in its reporting of the figures or whether they're just stupid, or whether they're just basically uninformed. And I personally think that they're just stupid. I think that when people talk about them conspiring to mislead the public, I really think you're giving people too much benefit for intelligence, which they frankly don't have. So I would say that this is really a question of just basic stupidity. And I think that what will happen in future is that the government will find out that people have rumbled this, and there will be a very severe and immediate about turn in the policy. And it has to happen. Because as long as the stimulus simply makes no effect on the economy, then nothing will happen in the future at all in terms of any increase in wealth. Wealth increases of its own right, in its own volition. It doesn't increase because people decide that stimulus packages are what's needed. It's like children. I mean, you can't correct a child that doesn't want to be corrected by punishing it. And this is what's basically happening right now. The taxpayers are being punished by having money stolen from them to feed the pet projects of the government, and none of it's having any effect. Now, what is, as I just mentioned, what is having an effect is that the states are not able to take up the slack where the federal government leaves off. So that as the federal government fills in the gaps, the states themselves are the ones who suffer because they have their money taken away, they have their basic tax money is dying on the vine because the consumer can't spend. And so the states have to put up taxes which basically cancels out all the effects of the stimulus which were not even effective in the first place. It's a very serious and very tragic situation, and one which is not going to get resolved certainly by government means. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, again, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call coming to you live from Singapore. And my call-in number, which I urge you to use and call in with some interesting questions and comments. And they don't have to be questions. It can be comments. It can be rants. Whatever it is you want to say, this is your show, and your calls have priority over everything else. And the number to use for that purpose is 888-873-4643. Again, the number to call in with your questions and your comments is a toll-free number, 888-873-4643. The engineer is standing by to take your calls. I will be notified immediately, and then I will invite you to ask them. Then, if you don't wish to do that, you may write in on the email, and I am always happy to receive your emails. And if you wish to do that, then please write to rm@gfawd.com. Now, the RM stands for Richard Martin, GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once more, the email that you can use to write in your questions. I have my email inbox open at all times to receive your emails. And the address is rm@gfawd.com. Okay? If you'd like to call me directly with your questions and your concerns and your problems and your worries, then please do that. Many people are doing that. I am very happy to receive your questions, and I will do what I can to alleviate your concerns. The number to call is a number in Sarasota, Florida, which will come through to me in Singapore. It is my local number, and it is a direct line to me as follows. Area code 941-441-1682. Okay. Once again, my number is 941-441-1682. So one way or another, ladies and gentlemen, you should be able to access me and the show. And hopefully you are in a mood to do so, because that's what I'm doing here. I am trying to educate and inform you of what is going on in the notable absence of the free press, so-called, which ought to be doing that job for me. This business of the Fed and their stimulus program, it's a complete misnomer, because we all know that Bernanke made a career out of studying the monetary so-called mistakes which were made during the 1930s Great Depression, as well as the Bank of Japan's errors of the 1990s through the early 2000s. And as he says, he's determined not to repeat them. Well, the U.S. economy in the years 1934 to 37 was rollicking along very nicely with nearly 9.5% rates of growth, before hitting a wall a second time. And even if the initial depression was not a direct result of government interference, which I believe it was, it can be absolutely shown without a shadow of a doubt that the economy, which was already beginning to pick up, was hit fairly and squarely in 1937 by the absurd policies of the government of the day under Roosevelt. Bernanke, however, believes that the Fed simply wasn't accommodative enough in the early 1930s, and he attributes the relapse into depression in 1938 to the decision to restrict credit. He believes that if he had been on the job back then, there would have been a far different outcome. Well, Bernanke has lectured about monetary policy mistakes in Japan, and advocated money printing
or monetizing the debt for tax relief and other types of stimulus. In the executive branch of the U.S. government, President Obama's chief economic advisor, Larry Summers, the director of the National Economic Council, promotes a concept of escape velocity, sufficiently high and sustained growth to propel the U.S. economy away from the gravitational pull of the deflationary forces caused by the debt liquidation and risk aversion associated with debt, period. Well, it is truly sad that Obama felt that he needed to employ the services of Larry Summers, who has manifestly been so very responsible for the current situation in which the country finds itself today, along with his buddies Rubin and Greenspan. It is truly the antics of a lunatic doing the same things over and over again and expecting a different result. And the only sad part about Obama is that clearly he had no knowledge of economics. He had no understanding of what the implications were of his choices. And so in a kind of desperate attempt to prolong the situation and write it with experienced people, he employed all these same spastic individuals who were so patently responsible for the problem in the first place. So, you know, unemployment is still rising, which of course is a 10%, 10.2% official rate and a 17.5% official rate using the U.S. Bureau of Statistics' own U6 alternative measures of labor utilization. And we must be a long way away from Summers' point of escape velocity. You know, one quarter of positive GDP growth does not make an economic rebound guaranteed in Summers or Bernanke's eyes, given the experience in 1937 after 4 years of economic rebound and several false starts in Japan. You know, while the Fed has the awesome power of the money printing machinery, it doesn't have the ability to determine where that newly created money will go. The Fed can't recreate the 8+ million jobs that have been lost in this recession. The Fed can't force companies to expand and hire, especially when other government policies, such as healthcare mandates, penalize hiring. In fact, the Fed can't even stop companies from laying off even more workers. You know, this time around, the Fed's newly printed cash is finding its way onto bank balance sheets, where it's hoarded, as I've mentioned so often, and plunged into emerging market stocks, into commodities, including oil and gold and bonds of all types, which is why, for example, you see that the stock market is up 120 points today and the bond market is up almost a full point, which is almost unprecedented. When the market is up this strongly, normally bonds collapse, but there is no demand for money and nobody wants to sell their holdings of bonds because they know very well that they've got nowhere else to put their money, which is of any degree of security. So the bond prices move up, despite whatever the stock market may be doing. You know, so this money is not finding its way out in the way that the federal government would like to see it go out. You know, the Fed board members are constantly talking tough, talking about their exit plan or their strategy, but it's all talk, 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 designed to hoodwink investors. And these central planners don't actually have an exit plan or an exit strategy. They have an exit theory, and the theory is flawed. The fact is that bureaucratic central planning doesn't work, and that the Fed's interference only causes greater problems, i.e. economic imbalances and asset bubbles. And central planning doesn't work because bureaucrats respond to political pressure. That means they won't make the tough decisions, the ones that cause pain. The only way central planning can work is if there's a hard-nosed independent leader at the Fed. Unfortunately, the likes of a Paul Volcker don't come around very often. you see this bunch of Fed heads saying, as Paul Volcker did, to hell with this economy in the short run, we need to fight inflation and we'll all be better off in the long run. And unfortunately, these people just simply take the easy route. Instead of letting the bad banks fail, they've accepted all kinds of toxic securities onto the balance sheet, which is utterly illegal according to the terms of the Fed, which has enabled massive record fiscal deficit spending by the U.S. government by buying U.S. government debts and printed money. The Fed is currently authorized to print or buy $1.75 trillion of securities. Nearly $1.2 trillion has already been injected into the system this year. The country's budget deficit in fiscal 2009 was $1.4 trillion. That $1.2 trillion was used directly or indirectly to finance the country's deficit. You know, Bill Gross of PIMCO said, and I quote, "In 2009, all we've been doing is selling those mortgage securities back to the market and to the Fed and replacing them with treasuries." End of quote. Who else would fund America's deficits at extremely low rates of interest? If the Fed wasn't buying, rates would rise. Houses couldn't be purchased with 3% down, FHA-backed mortgages. Include the $8,000 temporary tax credit for first-time homebuyers, and effectively, many are still buying homes with no money down. Of course, we now know that tens of thousands of cheats have gotten the $8,000 largely without even buying a home. Even taking rates down to 0% wasn't enough this time to extract America from the economic mess the Fed helped itself create. So the Fed embarked on the dangerous path of quantitative easing, i.e. money printing. And historically, this path has always been a ruinous one. Whenever governments begin creating money out of thin air, thereby devaluing currencies, their initial intention is surely to only do it for a short time or to reverse it when the economy gets better. Unfortunately, history shows that once one takes that wrong monetary fork, it's not so easy to change paths. The government doesn't correct itself as it would if left to its own devices, but becomes entirely dependent on the continuing flow of monetary juice. Despite the best intentions, it becomes impossible to pull back, and in fact, ever more juice is required just to maintain the economic illusion. That is the unfortunate history of fiat currencies, ladies and gentlemen. Without hard banking, without some limit on the ability to create money out of thin air, there's always some economic charlatan who comes along with a new theory, an easy way out of the mess. The names change, but the story is always the same, whether it's Roman Emperor Nero, the first of the Roman Empire to begin debasing the Roman coinage around 62 AD, the so-called brilliant John Law, France's Controller General of Finances, which by the way is equivalent to the chairman of the Fed, the money printer responsible for creating the Mississippi bubble and the chaotic economic collapse in France in the early 1700s. Or today's modern-day money printers, Ben Bernanke, and the UK's Mervyn King and other central bankers mostly following their lead. Well, I came across a very scary report from the chief executive of the city of Hong Kong. I was reading my version of the Straits Times the other day, because as you know, Obama has been, along with the other heads of state, in Singapore in the last few days. And Donald Tsang, the chief executive of the city of Hong Kong, said, and I quote, "America is doing exactly what Japan did last time," meaning that Japan's zero interest rate policy contributed to the 1997 Asian financial crisis and the U.S. mortgage meltdown. And as you know, Bernanke has overseen a record injection of liquidity into the world's largest economy, which of course is the United States, pledging not to make the same mistake of the 1930s. And Tsang's warning contrasts, of course, with pledges by the group of 20 nations representing the world's biggest economies to keep stimulus measures in place. And I quote again from Tang, "We have a US dollar carrier trade at the moment." Now remember I mentioned the carrier trade, I explained that last time. If the carry trade is investors borrowing cheaply in one currency and using the funds to invest in other currencies. Where is the money going, Tsang says? It's where the problem is going to be in Asia. You can see asset prices going up, not only in Korea, in Taiwan, in Singapore, and in Hong Kong, going up to levels that are incompatible, more inconsistent with the economic fundamentals. Well, Tang was Hong Kong's financial secretary during the 1997-98 Asian crisis, when countries from South Korea to Indonesia were forced to borrow from the International Monetary Fund because of an investor exodus sparked by concerns officials couldn't maintain the value of their currencies. Together with Hong Kong Monetary Authority Chief Joseph Yam, he intervened to buy $15 billion of Hong Kong stock, successfully defending the territory's exchange rate pegged to the dollar. Hong Kong's interest rates track those of the United States because of the country's pegged to the dollar, which means that foreign capital flows into stocks and property. Real estate prices in the city have risen more than 25% this year, prompting the International Monetary Fund to warn this month of a possible bubble. And Tsang said on November the 4th that the government was, quote, very concerned about the rise. Well, looking at Barry Eisengreen, who's professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, he said that, and I quote, Asia's bubbles now pose a serious threat to financial stability. And this is a task for emerging market central banks, not for the Fed or the European Central Bank. Now, I'm sure that Tang's words have not gone unheard in other Asian countries. You know, the World Bank president, who's also in Singapore for APEC, said that while Asian countries do face some risk of asset prices climbing, it's up to the region's officials to act. And I quote from Robert Zoellick, the World Bank president, and he said as follows. He said, given liquidity in the international marketplace and given the pace of recovery in East Asia, you could start to see some asset bubbles. There will be a need here, unlike you may have in Europe and North America, to look at actions such as Australia's rate boost this month. You know, Asia's central banks this year have increased holdings of US dollar assets, including treasuries, keep their currencies from rising and making exports more expensive relative to China's. While China's holdings of U.S. treasuries rose 10% this year, Japan has increased 16%, and those in the rest of Asia by 25%. Now, as you know, the dollar has tumbled 14% since the beginning of March, and the dollar has been hurt, of course, by a global recovery that has reduced investor appetite for the currency as a haven, and by expectations for the Fed to push its main rate near a record low into 2010. The IMF, in a report last week, said these trades may be contributing to upward pressure on the euro and some emerging economy currencies. Fed policymakers last week reiterated that they would pledge to keep borrowing costs exceptionally low for an extended period to aid the U.S. recovery. The APEC finance ministers, in a joint statement yesterday, committed to maintain stimulus efforts until a durable recovery in private demand is secured. Well, of course, they all want strong dollar. In France, the U.S. Treasury Secretary reiterated his commitment to a strong dollar policy in a trip to Asia this week. But, of course, that's all talk. He has to say that. But his intention is quite clear, which is that he needs to pay back the debt that has been incurred by these foreign countries at a price which is considerably lower than today's price. And the only way he can do that is by allowing the dollar to fall. There are plenty of ways in which the United States government could allow the dollar to rally if they wanted to, but they don't want to. And this is always the case. The Treasury and the federal chairman always say that they are going to let the dollar rise and allow it to rise because they want it to rise and it's good for the American economy. They always say that, but they never do. It's just a pure lie put out for the benefit of PR, and that's about it. I believe I may have a question. Let me have a look. Margot Froelich has written in and said, "Hi, Richard. Thanks for staying up late for us. I have read of Najess's American Cafe site that the Fed is beginning to dump on various banks the toxic waste which it brought up during the last year and making it mandatory that they take it. The article said this is especially true with BOA, which would become weaker as a result and would result in a bankruptcy for them. Would you comment, please?" Well, there is a degree of scandal involved in this, Margot, because actually what happened was that the Fed basically twisted the arm of these banks by saying, you know, if you don't do what we want you to do, we will create conditions which are so onerous for you that you basically won't be able to go on doing business. This has been discussed in many programs on television that I have certainly been aware of, including, Bill Moyers has talked about it. Frontline has done a piece on it. Now on PBS with David Bancaccio, has done a piece, at least one piece, and possibly even two, on this very situation. The grim reality is that many of these banks were forced into doing things which they should not have done for the benefit of their shareholders because the government told them to do them. And to compound the problem, they kept the details away from shareholders, which is absolutely a no-no and totally illegal. And situation where the shareholders might sue the companies for withholding information of this nature, the companies would surely lose. And I haven't seen any evidence that this has happened yet, and I'm very surprised that that is the case, because certainly in the case in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch situation, where Merrill Lynch was basically bought up by Bank of America under false pretenses, and with the shareholders being denied the relevant knowledge with which to make a decision about whether or not to sell out the shares, it seems to have gone completely under the bridge, and nobody has made a fuss about this, even though it was actually discussed overtly in many of the financial media. It's just as though it had never happened. And so, government has forced these banks to do this, Margot, just as you say, and they've forced them to raise the prices on their debt in order to make it seem that, you know, there was some kind of a market there, and presumably to stimulate the rest of the off-balance sheet material into being sold at higher prices. It has manifestly failed. This has not worked. None of the toxic assets have been sold in the way that the government would have hoped. And of course, as you point out, Margot, Bank of America is now immeasurably weaker as a result, and probably along with Citigroup, will at some point in the next 2 or 3 years go into bankruptcy. I believe very strongly that these two banks will go bankrupt, both of them. And it gets to the point of, first of all, diminishing returns, where the more stimulus that you give, the less effect it has. And then finally, it reaches the point of no return, where there is simply nothing more to be done than to liquidate the banks. But of course, by that time, the situation is much, much worse. The problems are much worse. The debts are much worse. And so the general public suffers that much more. The government, of course, knows this. But they have their own personal political reasons, along with all the lobbying that gets done, to fulfill the needs of these companies. So it's exactly the same as it was back in the 30s. It seems to me that the press is no more responsible and conscientious in its reporting of these facts than they ever were, which is actually very, very sad. But part of the course, I'm afraid, Margot, and thank you very much indeed for the question. Let me see what else I have here. I get an email from Al Berry, and Al Berry writes and says, "Dear Richard, it would seem that government debt," and by the way, he's quoting from Comstock, "debt dynamics will hold back economy." And this is what Comstock has to say, as quoted by Al Berry. "Dear, it would seem that government debt has merely replaced private debt, indicating to me that there will be no inflation. Of course, the value of the dollar will continue to fall, and sooner or later, 5 to 10 years, inflation will become a fact. What is your opinion?" Well, my opinion used to be, Al, that we would indeed see inflation in maybe as little as 2 or 3 years, and certainly within 4 or 5. I am now of the opinion, and it's becoming stronger and stronger with me, this opinion, that the inherent economic and financial rot is increasing at such a gigantic pace that the possibility that the consumer will have at any time in the next 15 or 20 years the wherewithal to create inflation is becoming so far-fetched that I actually am beginning to doubt that we will see inflation within this or the next generation. It would be somewhat ironic if that would be the case, because the last time that we saw no inflation was in the mid to late 19th century, when there was, in fact, no central bank. And if Ron Paul was successful, the Fed will be disbanded at some point in disgrace. And if and when that happens, there will be, indeed, no real need for inflation, because there will be nobody there to pump money into the system. And, of course, inflation is a monetary phenomenon involving an increase, a net increase in the supply of money and credit. So if you don't see that increase, you don't get inflation. So I'm not so sure that I would assume, Al, that the dollar will continue to fall. I think that the dollar will rise at some point in the near future, because I think that there will be a need for dollars to cover debt. And I think that that will tend to push down the price of all these commodities, including gold and silver, and make it very scary as a prospect for longer-term holders in these markets to actually continue to hang on to them. But then I think the chances are, at a much later stage, that the dollar will in fact continue to fall. But that takes us, you know, way beyond where I think I need to go at this particular moment. I got a question a little while back from Gary Wagner, who says, "What will the government's continued intervention do to change this downturn? As they said last week, they will continue to do so. Never saw this before. Stores are offering online Black Friday deals this weekend." Gary, there isn't anything they can do. Really, there isn't. I mean, if the consumer cannot consume, then the government simply cannot force the issue of a downturn turning into an upturn. They can't do it. They can intervene as much as they like, But it's the old story of pushing against the stream. You know, I mean, there's nothing that they can do about that. So I don't think that that is an issue. I think it has become a sore point with the planners at the central government level, that they realize that they cannot achieve their goals by simply trying to force people to buy things they don't want, like the Cash for Clunkers program or the $8,000 allowance for first-time home buyers. It, frankly, is a non-starter. And it's just giving away taxpayers' money. And when it becomes evident that the taxpayer is fed up, you know, as might be evident in, you know, a tax strike where people simply refuse to pay their taxes. I don't think that's likely to happen, but it certainly could. And that will come about when people realize that their tax money is simply being thrown away, good money after bad. So I hope I answered your question. I mean, I just don't think that there's any hope, as it were, for the system. I got a message last week from Steve Kruger, who said, "Richard, you can sense the fear the government has about deflation, as there is nothing they can do about it. They have missed the chance to pull a Warren Harding and just refuse to help any failing bank with bailouts. This would have been the right thing to do. Harding's inaction is what brought on the Roaring Twenties. That ship has sailed. With rates at zero, the only tool the Fed has left is to give out money with both hands." Steve Kruger, P.S. On a lighter note, how come Singapore is the only nation I know of that doesn't turn the clock back and forth twice a year? Of the 6 billion people of the world, only the people of Singapore have discovered that if you cut one foot off the top of a blanket and sew it on the bottom, you don't wind up with a longer blanket. Oh, Steve, thank you for that little piece of wisdom. Yes, back to your original point, Steve. You say the rates at zero, the only tool the Fed has left is to give out money with both hands. It's not even a tool. It's a blunt knife. It's not going to cut it. And, you know, whether they know this or not, I don't know. I feel that there is so much stupidity inherent in the antics of these people that they probably don't realize that what they're doing is a complete waste of time. But what can you do? All right. Well, you know, it occurred to me the other day when I was thinking about what really should be taught at schools in terms of giving people some idea about how to manage their finances and how to deal with you know, life in the financial fast lane. So many people are resentful now that they can't buy a house because house prices are so high. As though, you know, buying a house was the birthright of every American. I didn't remember seeing that in the Constitution, by the way, that, you know, the right to pursue happiness involves an automatic right to buy a house. You know, renting is a perfectly satisfactory way of living, you know. And I was thinking, you know, of the various different things that really should be taught in schools to equip people of all ages for the rigors of an unexpected economic downturn. Because of course, when things go well, they don't need help particularly, although they do need help to make sure that things don't go too well and you don't get into a bubble. But I think that school kids should be taught how to save money, how much to save before you buy a house, how to do a budget, how to plan for buying a car, how to do the maths on buying versus renting, how to live within their means and not feel like a Scrooge, how to assess financial risk of investing, how to build a pyramid base of solid financial footing, such as savings, laddered CDs, treasuries, stocks, ETFs, precious metals, etc. How to buy insurance, indeed, whether to buy insurance, what makes sense, what doesn't, and how much they need to buy, how to set aside money for college, and how to make the decision not to indebt themselves for the first 20 years after college with student loans, how to do a simple ROI on their college investment, what kind of jobs are going to earn them real money in the future, and what careers or degrees are an entire waste of money, time, etc. How a college degree guarantees you nothing, and how students should consider working full-time on or internships before graduating college. Well, I think you'd agree with me, ladies and gentlemen, that in the case of a curriculum like that, kids will be much more equipped to leave school with something approaching financial sanity under their belts. But for some reason I never understood, schools always consider the aspect of economics to be the bailiwick of the family, the parents. Those are parents would feel, many parents would be very hard done by, their children were being told how to spend and save the money that they manifestly don't teach them to do themselves, but that's another of life's, one of life's curious little ironies. Okay, well, Wall Street chronicler Charlie Gasparino was interviewed recently. He said his greatest regret in life was not going through with the Golden Gloves boxing competition he dreamt of as a teenager. A tough guy, he he's run hot and cold. He just came out with a book called The Sellout, which could become the definitive book on the current financial crisis and the events that led up to the Great Recession, so-called. The book, The Sellout, pulls no punches in chronicling the rise and fall of excessive Wall Street leverage and risk-taking, as well as the cast of colorful characters that ultimately brought the financial system to its knees. It's in the bookshelves now, and maybe worth a read. He was asked when he thought the Wall Street disaster was actually going to happen, and he said that he didn't know when it was going to happen, but that if history was any guide, it would be happening very soon, along with another financial crash. He said that allowing firms to fail was the obvious only solution, which doesn't necessarily have to mean Armageddon, but he says that the Fed and the Treasury should have walked away when systemic loss was smaller and the damage would have been limited. And he says they should have started doing that back in 1998. And I would agree with him entirely. 1998, when Clinton was still around, was really the beginning of the rot with the collapse of LTCM, long-term capital management, and the meltdown in the Asian countries. Well, he was asked, actually, interestingly enough, his opinion about Goldman Sachs. He did say that he didn't think the Goldman Sachs was in a sort of evil camp, he really believes, as do a lot of the smart people that he's been talking to, that Goldman's bankers and traders virtually control the federal government in order to advance their own notorious agenda. He says that there were far worse players whose risk-taking led to last year's meltdown, starting with Merrill Lynch and Citigroup. And apparently he makes this point in The Sellout. I haven't read The Sellout. I've read excerpts from it, but I can't say that I've read the book, so I'm not going to be able to say that I can recommend it. But it does seem to be fairly no-nonsense, taut tightly written account of the meltdown. Remember that after Robert Rubin tried so hard to end the Glass-Steagall separation of investment and commercial banking, he didn't go back to his old firm Goldman Sachs. He went to work for the firm that benefited the most from that law's demise, which was Citigroup. Now, Gasparino says that Goldman, in many ways, crystallizes all that is wrong with the financial bailout, which, of course, as we know, was started by the Bush administration, but carried on and expanded as though nothing had happened by Obama. Of course, it was very convenient for Goldman to be declared a bank. They don't take deposits and offer checking accounts, but they trade, and actually they're trading as a federally protected bank because they achieved banking status last year. That really has the effect of allowing them to borrow at cheaper rates and becoming, as they say, too big to fail. Gasparino really never thought that the Feds would let Lehman fail. And in fact, there's a discussion of that very point in the book. The question is that if the government was going to let to bail out a firm like Lehman, you know, why wouldn't the exuberant people at Morgan and Goldman and Merrill Lynch think that they could take enormous leverage and carry enormous amounts of high yield debt on their books? You know, they all thought things that when things got tough, the government would be there with a paycheck ready to bail them out. So finally, he was asked who were on the top of the list of people who should be held accountable for the unraveling of the global financial system. He, of course, talks about the political correct answer, politically correct answer, which would include a long list of CEOs like Stan O'Neill of Merrill, Sandy Weill, Chuck Prince at Citigroup, Jimmy Cain at Bear, and of course the former Lehman CEO, Dick Fuld. He also refers to the various heads of HUD like Henry Cisneros and Andrew Cuomo, and all those in the Bush administration who felt that owning a home was a right rather than something that should be earned. And of course, Greenspan, as always, who comes up in everyone's shopping list of villains for handing out free money to Wall Street every time the big firms screwed up over the past 30 years, which, of course, gave them an incentive to double down on their risky bets, until, of course, they doubled down so much the system blew up. He is very scathing about Obama. He says Obama has done nothing more than maintain the status quo that began under Bush, which we all know. The banks and Wall Street are being bailed out through subsidies. Main Street gets no relief other than stimulus money that does nothing to stimulate the part of the economy that creates jobs outside Wall Street. So, unemployment is growing above 10%, and yet bankers are making money based on government subsidies. Obviously a healthy banking system is needed to survive, but when Goldman Sachs, which isn't even a real bank, gets treated like one, but of course not when it comes to handing out bonuses, because banks don't hand out bonuses in the way that freewheeling investment companies and trading companies do. Interesting book, interesting man, probably well worth a look. He's been hot and cold on Wall Street. He's been good, he's been bad, a little bit of everything. But the man he's got his head screwed on, and he knows, what other people should know. Obviously, a lot of the people who've been bullish in the market are now turning bearish because the economy is going downhill so fast. It makes no sense to assume that Wall Street can just go on printing money like nothing had happened. One of the latest that this happened to was Mark Farber, who says in his latest doom, boom, and gloom report, and I quote, "The future will be a total disaster with a collapse of our capitalistic system as we know it today." Now that's, of course, a really strongly worded comment. And I think he's right. I mean, there's no question that things can't go on as they've been going on. They certainly can't go on getting worse, which they are. I did see Michael Moore's movie, that, Capitalism. I was not impressed with it. He condescends to the most idiotic nonsense at the end of the movie. The first part of the movie is pretty good, perhaps if you don't know the story, but the end of it seems to me to be just sentimental codswallop, which is thrown in for good measure. Yet again, a filmmaker who's fallen in love with himself, who thinks that what he thinks is more important than anything else. And of course, there's too much of Michael Moore in the movie, and it's a shame. I don't know whether he'll make any more movies, but he should really rethink his strategy if he does, because he's got a good mind on him and good analytical and critical skills, but he needs to harness them quickly now before they go completely out of hand. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We'll be back again on Friday, and I hope you have a good week ahead. And this is Richard Martin from The Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then. Take care.